Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Smell, a Very Short Introduction, by Matthew Cobb, narrated by Dennis Kleinman. Publisher's note: in the audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Chapter 1. How We Smell. What is your favorite smell? People often choose baking bread, freshly brewed coffee, or the zing of an orange. My own choices would be petrichor, the smell produced when rain has fallen on dry soil, the resiny tang of pine forests, or, above all, the comforting warm smell of the back of a baby's head. Sensing each of these smells brings back experiences associated with them in a way that does not happen so richly for, say, vision or sound. Smell is special. Smell, or olfaction, to give it its scientific name, is probably the oldest sense. Organisms were able to detect chemicals in their environment and directly respond to them long before they could see or feel, although the mechanisms involved have long since changed profoundly. Animals use smell for a range of essential functions, such as finding food, avoiding predators, locating shelter, obtaining a mate, or as a fundamental part of memory. To detect those smells, they use a variety of structures. Vertebrates bring odors into their body via their nostrils or mouth, while insects and crustaceans use antennae to capture odors. Other animals, such as worms or snails, have specialized organs on their heads that serve the same function. In all cases, these organs are linked directly to the brain, enabling the animal to rapidly identify a smell and its location and to respond appropriately to it. Despite being so fundamental for all animals, including us, the sense of smell remains mysterious. We understand far less about it than we do vision, touch, taste, or hearing. The enigma of olfaction can be highlighted by trying to describe a scent. The words we use generally refer to other smells, or perhaps to some multisensory term like green. To put it technically, what is the dimensionality of smell? We can define visual and auditory stimuli in terms of wavelength and intensity, but odors resist verbal categorization. There are some exceptions to this in English: musty, acrid, dank, but in general, we do not have words for smells. The best scientists can do is to classify odors, which are molecules, by their various component atoms, size, and structure, which seem to be linked with how we perceive the odor. For example, the smell of rotting vegetable matter is largely due to the presence of sulfur atoms in the molecule. Sweets, like pear drops, smell the way they do because the key aroma they contain is a small molecule composed of carbon and hydrogen atoms, forming what is called an ester. Esters and sulfurs are examples of functional groups which affect both the chemical behavior of the molecule and how we perceive it. These effects interact with the overall size or length of the molecule to give many smells their unique characteristics. Most of the odors with which we are familiar are organic molecules, that is, they contain carbon, which is omnipresent on Earth. Our perception of odors changes as the molecule gets longer or more complex, or different functional groups are added. Although we have developed machines that can precisely identify the atomic composition of odors, we are unable, for the moment, to produce a systematic classification that is faithful both to the molecular structures of smells and to our perception of them. In ancient Greece and Rome, materialist philosophers such as Democritus and Lucretius argued that given all matter is made of atoms, then smells must be made of atoms too. They decided that things that smell nice must be made of round atoms, while sharp and acrid smells must have pointy atoms. While the detail is obviously wrong, the basic idea is correct. There is a link between the molecular structure of a smell and how we perceive it. What exactly that link is, we do not know. The dimensionality of smell, if that is even the right way of thinking about it, remains unknown. The molecular limits of smell are not easy to define. Humans perceive odors that are present in the air. This requires molecules to be volatile, which is a function of the size of the molecule. If it is too heavy, it cannot get airborne, and of both temperature and humidity, higher levels of both these factors increase the likelihood of an odor being released from its substrate. It is often argued that molecules consisting of more than 23 carbons are not volatile, but this figure is not an absolute threshold, and temperature and pressure will alter the exact point at which an odor takes to the air. Furthermore, even on the stillest of days, air currents will transport smell molecules. All this is different for smells in water, which need to be soluble and will slowly diffuse as well as being carried by the current. Most studies of smell, whether in humans or other animals, are done in the laboratory, where brief pulses of single odors of known composition and concentration are presented to a subject and their responses are recorded. But the real world is not like a laboratory. Most scents that we smell in the real world are not single molecules, but blends of different compounds. For example, a rose produces over 250 identifiable molecules in its fragrance, although that does not mean that when we smell a rose, we are detecting all of them. In the case of the tomato, there are over 400 molecules in its bouquet, but only a couple of dozen are detectable by humans. The olfactory world is far richer than we imagine. Odors also come in different concentrations, and our feelings about an odor change with its intensity. Imagine the difference between a dab of perfume behind the ears and spilling the whole bottle on the carpet. What is called the hedonic value of the odor, whether it is nice or nasty, may change with concentration, and yet Chanel No. 5 still smells like Chanel No. 5 in all cases. Working out how our brains process such everyday experiences is one of the challenges faced by olfactory neuroscience. Four myths of smell. Because our grasp of smell is so poor, a number of myths and misunderstandings have accumulated around this sense. Clearing them up at the outset will help you on this journey to the center of scent. Myth 1. You smell with your nose. Although we can indeed smell by inhaling through our nostrils, we detect odors using neurons that are directly connected to the brain, which dangle down through the base of the skull at about eye level. Really, you are smelling with your brain. Myth 2. You smell molecules in the air. The molecules we smell are carried on the air, but we do not directly detect airborne odors. If your olfactory neurons were in contact with the air, they would shrivel and die. Instead, these neurons, which are found in a thin layer of skin called the olfactory epithelium, are protected by a layer of mucus. A similar thing happens with insects. Their olfactory neurons bathe in liquid housed in their sensory hairs. For obvious reasons, aquatic organisms can only sense odors in water. Yes, fish, crabs, lobsters, and so on all smell too. Any airborne molecule you want to smell has to get through that protective liquid barrier. For this to happen, there are special molecules called odorant binding proteins, OBPs, that are found in that mucus, effectively on the outside of your body. Their role seems to be to transport smell molecules through the mucus and deliver them to the receptors on the olfactory neurons. Myth 3. We have a poor sense of smell. For a long time, scientists agreed with this claim, but in 2017, the neuroscientist John McGann of Rutgers University highlighted the real situation in an article entitled "Poor Human Olfaction is a 19th Century Myth." He summarized the key evidence and concluded that human olfaction is excellent and impactful. While it is generally the case that your sense of smell might be diminished if you are aged or if you smoke, and you will generally be better at smelling if you are a female, overall women have a more acute sense of smell than men, in reality, we all have an atomic nose. Your sense of smell can distinguish between molecules that differ in size by a single atom of carbon. People describe heptanol, an alcohol made of 7 carbon atoms, as smelling violet, sweet, woody, while octanol, just 1 carbon atom more, smells sweet, orange, rose. Caraway, one of the components of curry, smells different from spearmint. The two smells have exactly the same atomic composition, but their structure is different. The molecules are mirror images of each other, like two gloves. The difference in our perception of those two odors is due to the way our olfactory neurons respond to the different molecular orientations. So fine is our sense of smell that the number of odors we can distinguish may be near infinite. For decades, researchers repeated that the average human could distinguish about 10,000 odors, but this figure had no scientific basis. In 2014, researchers in the laboratory of my good friend Leslie Vosshall at Rockefeller University tried to estimate how many smells we might be able to tell apart based on mixtures of molecules. They came up with the astonishing figure of over a trillion. Although this mathematical model has been challenged, it seems probable that there is no real limit to the number of odors we can detect. The same will apply to many other animals. Myth 4. We do not use smell much. Your sense of smell and your sense of taste are intimately connected. If you try eating something tasty while pinching your nose, making sure your mouth is shut, you will find that there is little flavor. But when you take your fingers away, you should get a sudden rush of sensation as volatile compounds from the food you are chewing whoosh up your nasal cavity and flow over your olfactory neurons high in your head. This is called retronasal olfaction and is one of the two ways you can detect odors. The other way is called orthonasal olfaction, or more simply, sniffing. Our sense of taste is relatively rudimentary, divided into a small number of classes, the traditional salt, sour, bitter, and sweet, together with the more recently identified umami, meaty, fatty, hot, spicy, metallic, and the taste of carbon dioxide, while our perception of flavor is a mixture of the simple world of taste and the rich multiple dimensions of smell. In many languages, flavor is colloquially called taste, even though smell may be the dominant sense giving flavor its subtlety. People who have no sense of smell, they are described as being anosmic, through injury, disease, or for genetic reasons, or simply because they are elderly, may find that their enjoyment of food is reduced because they cannot smell properly. They may worry excessively about leaving the gas on or about their personal hygiene. Indeed, permanent loss of the sense of smell can lead to mental health problems, as once familiar odors, the scent of loved ones, for example, are no longer perceptible. Disease and damage can also cause people to sense odors that are not actually there. This is known as phantosmia. This may be relatively benign. When I get a cold, I sometimes smell what I can only describe as weird toast, but in some cases, it can be very disturbing, as people continually smell feces or vomit, or even unnameable and unidentifiable smells. These biological effects are melded with cultural norms over which smells are and are not socially acceptable. Over recent decades in the West, we have become very conscious of avoiding personal odors and spend a great deal of money and effort trying to ensure we do not smell of sweat or other odors that are perceived as unpleasant. In other times and other societies, different rules have applied. Smell has long been a powerful aspect of human culture. Fragrances have been used in rituals and ceremonies down the ages, while perfumes, often based on animal sources, such as musk from the scent glands of deer or from plants, have been a significant part of many cultures. The modern perfume industry is perpetually creating new scents that promise glamour and excitement for both genders, in a way that other products cannot. Smell has even been used to tell the time. From the 11th century onwards, Chinese temples used aroma clocks containing powdered incense that burned at a particular rate to release different scents at different times. Smell is not just a mysterious biological phenomenon with fascinating examples from across the animal kingdom, it is also a key part of our social existence that often goes unrecognized. By understanding it better, using examples from a wide range of animals, we can gain insight not only into the natural world, but also its role in our culture. To do that, we first need to understand how exactly the sense of smell works. What follows is a bit technical, but I've done my best to keep it simple and to avoid unnecessary detail. When we encounter striking examples of human and animal smelling later on in the book, remember that they are all based on these processes. In some cases, our knowledge is so precise that we can explain those examples in terms of what is going on in our cells and our brains. This amazing machinery, which we do not fully understand, is at work in your head and that of every other animal on the planet right now. The mechanics of smell. Each species of animal can detect a different range of odors. No species can detect all the molecules that are present in the environment in which it lives. There are some things that we cannot smell, but which other terrestrial animals can, and vice versa. There are also differences between individuals relating to the ability to smell an odor or how pleasant it seems. For example, some people like the taste of coriander, known as cilantro in the USA, while others find it soapy and unpleasant. This effect has an underlying genetic component due to differences in the genes controlling our sense of smell. If you hate the taste of coriander, try eating it with your mouth closed while holding your nose. It won't taste soapy. Ultimately, the selection of scents detected by a given species and how that odor is perceived will depend upon the animal's ecology. The response profile of each species will enable it to locate sources of smell that are relevant to it and to respond accordingly. Despite these differences between species, the way in which odors are processed is fundamentally similar in all animals, from the initial detection in the periphery right through to deciding how to respond. When a terrestrial animal first encounters an odor, the smell is absorbed by the mucus, in the case of vertebrates, or the fluid-filled interior of a sensory hair, in the case of an arthropod, as the odor molecule binds to an odorant-binding protein, OBP. These proteins appear to act as molecular chaperones, transporting the odor to the receptor through the protective mucus or fluid. Their precise functions are still unclear, but their significance in the ecology of some animals is known. For example, in the fly Drosophila sicellia, the presence of one kind of OBP enables these insects to exploit the pungent fruit of the Indian mulberry, Morinda citrifolia, by detecting the plant's unique odor, something that competing species which lack this protein cannot do. In pandas, one particular OBP binds with odors that are found in bamboo, the animal's sole food. In some species, these proteins seem to do other things, such as responding to humidity or detecting chemical signals inside the body, as well as carrying out their chaperone function. Intriguingly, although humans have a number of genes that enable us to synthesize these proteins, only one kind of OBP has so far been detected in our olfactory epithelium. It has been suggested that small variations in this gene, which lead to changes in the structure of the protein, may explain inter-individual differences in olfactory sensitivity. The protective fluid or mucus also contains enzymes that snip up smell molecules, removing them after they have been smelled, or even preventing some compounds from being smelled in the first place. For example, benzaldehyde is a small molecule that smells like almonds. Mice appear not to be able to smell this odor because enzymes in the animal's mucus degrade it into two components, benzyl alcohol and benzoic acid. Similar things seem to happen in your nose. In our olfactory mucus, the molecule hexanol gets turned into hexanol, suggesting that we cannot actually smell hexanol. Our sense of smell, like our other senses, is filtered and selected even before it gets to our brains. In vertebrates, olfactory neurons are located in the olfactory epithelium, a layer of skin on the underside of the skull that is effectively divided into two halves, each associated with one of your nasal cavities and projecting to one half of the brain. In some species, such as sheep or dogs, the olfactory epithelium can be relatively large because the nasal cavity contains very convoluted bony structures called turbinates, which are covered with the olfactory epithelium. This large surface area increases the sensitivity of the olfactory system by increasing the number of receptors. In a mouse, the olfactory epithelium is rolled up into a tiny space. Unraveled, it covers about 140 square millimeters, or an area about the size of the top half of the mouse's head. There are supposedly about 10 million neurons packed onto that surface. In your nose, the epithelium covers about 900 square millimeters, 6 times larger than a mouse's. There are as yet no reliable estimates for the number of human olfactory neurons, but the number clearly runs into millions. Once an odor molecule has arrived at the olfactory neuron, it binds to one of many millions of receptor proteins on the surface of the neuron. Each olfactory cell expresses just one type of receptor, subtly changing the receptor shape. Most of the receptors in your nose are called G-protein-coupled receptors, GPCRS, because they are connected to a molecule called a G-protein, which is found in many cells in our bodies. G-proteins act as a kind of molecular relay, responding to the change in receptor conformation by producing a chemical cascade inside the cell. If this cascade is large enough, if enough receptors have been activated, it leads to what is called an action potential in the neuron, a rolling electrical charge that travels rapidly along the cell. Each odor produces a unique response in a particular olfactory neuron. Part of the difficulty in working out how exactly receptors and odors interact is that, in general, each odor can activate more than one olfactory receptor, and each receptor can be activated by more than one odor. Some receptors are very broad and can be activated by a large number of odors. Others are much more narrowly tuned and respond only to a small number of ecologically significant smells, or particularly, in the case of pheromones, chemical signals between members of the same species, sometimes to just one kind of odor molecule. The complex pattern of activity in the periphery of our olfactory system is called a combinatorial code. Each odor produces a unique pattern of neuronal activation of a specific subset of olfactory neurons, which is the basis of our perception of different odors. The olfactory combinatorial code is particularly complex because neurons do not respond in a digital manner, on or off. Each neuron can be excited or inhibited by different odors, and the intensity with which the neuron fires and the overall shape of its response, which it sends to the cells connected to it, also provide information to the brain. Even those neurons that do not change their activity when an odor is encountered, because the smell cannot bind with the receptor, contribute to the overall pattern of activity produced by each odor. No change in the activity of one class of olfactory neuron may provide significant information to the brain about what odor is being detected. This rich and complex response profile in the periphery shows how, with 400 types of receptor, the human olfactory system could theoretically detect a near-infinite range of odors. The anatomy of smell detection. Despite the differences in the way animals detect smells, with noses, antennae, and various other organs, we all process the signals in a similar way. In some species, the distribution of different types of olfactory neuron across the surface of the olfactory epithelium, or the antenna, shows some degree of organization. One neuron type may be more densely distributed in some regions than in others. In other animals, such as fish, the distribution of olfactory neurons appears to be random. Where there is a spatial organization of these cells, it may mean that the brain has an idea of what kind of odor has been detected simply by being able to identify which region of the olfactory organ is responding. Once it has been activated, each olfactory neuron sends its response into the brain, where the neuron converges with all the cells that express the same receptor type to form a ball-like structure called a glomerulus. In a vertebrate brain, there are hundreds or even thousands of these structures, depending on the species. In some animals, there is one glomerulus per receptor type. In others, such as humans, there may be several glomeruli for each type. Furthermore, all brains in all animals are bilaterally symmetrical, so there are two sets of glomeruli, one on each side of the brain. This is a key difference between smell and taste in all animals. Neurons that detect odors are directly connected to the brain, whereas those that detect tastes are not. Furthermore, the taste regions of the brain have no glomerular structure. By gathering signals from many olfactory neurons of the same type, the glomeruli enable the animal to be more certain that a particular type of receptor has been activated. Just as the response of neurons is not binary, either on or off, the activity of glomeruli can be more or less intense and also contains a temporal element. Each glomerulus responds to different odors with activity that shows different intensities, time courses, and durations. As a result, each odor/glomerulus combination produces a specific, unique, and repeatable output. The same glomerulus can respond in different ways to different odors, and the same odor can induce a different response in different glomeruli. Where several glomeruli are activated by the same odor, those that respond first tend to be linked to neurons with the most sensitive receptors for that odor. These glomeruli, which respond within 1/10 of a second of the stimulus arriving at the receptor, are those that seem to play the biggest role in enabling us to identify an odor. Some of the cells that take the signal from the glomeruli up into the higher areas of the brain respond to particular durations of glomerular activation, the difference between a whiff and a stench. In terrestrial vertebrates, the brain also has to be able to cope with changes in stimulation and sensitivity associated with a normal breathing cycle. Although sniffing can increase our detection of an odor, we do not normally perceive our sense of smell changing with every breath we take. Filtering out that uninformative breathing rhythm and providing a relatively constant perception is dealt with higher up in the brain. The same goes for smells that are constantly present. We eventually tune them out. This highlights the fact that our olfactory perception and its underlying mechanisms have a high degree of plasticity. Glomeruli located close to each other in the brain tend to respond to odors that have some similarities. For example, in the bee brain, glomeruli responding strongly to odors with the same functional group, alcohols, aldehydes, and so on, tend to be grouped together with neighboring glomeruli responding to chemicals with the same functional group but of different sizes. In other words, the spatial organization in the brain reflects aspects of the chemical structure of odors. There can be a functional aspect to this organization. In the mouse olfactory bulb, the 50 or so glomeruli that lead to an aversive response to the smells of spoiled food are grouped together at the top of the bulb, while those that appear to be involved in responses to food preferences are strung together in a long line going from top to bottom. Glomeruli involved in pheromonal responses tend to be grouped together, with separate regions for those involved with reproduction, social behaviors, alarm signals, and so on. Glomeruli interact with each other through neurons that gather signals from neighboring glomeruli. These signals, called mitral cells and tufted cells in vertebrates, lateral neurons and projection neurons in insects, alter the activity and output of the glomerulus, depending on how neighboring glomeruli have also been activated by the odor. Changes to the activity of the glomeruli can involve what is called lateral inhibition. Strong activation of one glomerulus may reduce the activity of a neighbor. This process, which occurs in many parts of the nervous system, sharpens the signal, increasing the certainty that a particular stimulus has been detected. The complex signal patterns that emerge from the glomerular layer of the brain are not simply a translation of the activity of the olfactory neurons. This processing in the brain is the first stage of our perception of smells. One part of the output of the glomerular layer goes into brain regions associated with perception and the organization of appropriate behavioral responses. The other part goes to regions linked with encoding memory, the hippocampus in a mammal and the mushroom body in an insect. This means that the animal is continuously associating odors in the environment with things that are happening to it. Exactly how the pattern of activation at these higher levels leads to the perception of a given odor is not clear in any animal. There are a number of theoretical models.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?